Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me today to start the show is Joe Archer. He's the forester for Logan City, and we're going to talk about mosquito abatement districts. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Joe, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
So tell me, do you know how long has the mosquito abatement district for Logan been around?
Really don't. It's we've been spraying for a long time. It's 20 years that I know of.
20, okay.
21.
So it predates the West Nile virus coming into the U.S. And there's a second abatement district in the valley for Cache Valley, Cache County. And there was talk 5 months or so ago about possibly combining the two districts. But as we talked before the program, that's not really in the process right now.
Correct. There's actually three. Young and College Ward.
Oh, okay, great.
Have their own mosquito abatement district.
So tell me how an abatement district works. I know from just living in Hyde Park, I hear the truck when it comes through. It's usually the same night every single week, beginning sometime in early summer. I'm sure you're probably monitoring the populations of mosquitoes. But tell me the basics of an abatement district.
They're all different.
Your district.
My district, it's not really a mosquito abatement district. It's a division of within the city of Logan. A lot of abatement districts, Cache Valley, I believe it is, a mosquito abatement district, they are an entity unto themselves. They're not supervised by the county. They have a board of directors.
And that was something that got voted in. I mean, they just couldn't create the district on their own. Where it sounds like with Logan City, it's a department within the city that the city created.
Correct.
So when you're trying to suppress mosquito populations, what methods do you use?
We do it twofold. Larvicide, we try to do, and particularly we like to do a lot of education, one of the reasons I'm here. And then adulticide. Adulticide, we try to do as little as possible. Larvicide, because it's so species specific, we do a lot of that. I've got a technician out right now killing larvae.
So tell me how that works, because usually when the truck comes by, it's like, again, it's at night, same day of the week, but they're fogging. And when you're doing the larvicide, what's the chemical that you're using with the larvicide? Sorry, going to get that a little specific. But you say it goes specific to only mosquito larvae. It doesn't bother other larvae?
Correct. There's two things. There's one of them is a chemical that holds it in the larva stage so it doesn't pupate. The second one's a bacteria that attacks only mosquitoes. You can put that in a pool with dragonfly nymphs, which also feed on mosquito larvae. Doesn't affect them. Only mosquitoes. The only thing that affects all the species is a serpent that we spray on, and we do this on mud puddles. Something that's going to be there for a few days, which is long enough for them to hatch out mosquitoes. But that's the only thing that actually would affect. It's not species specific.
So are these just mud puddles along the side of the road that you're looking for?
Yes.
Probably right after a rainstorm has come through.
Correct.
That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the larvicide itself, my main concern was, and I've had monarch butterflies every year since I was a little kid, and the numbers of the populations have just dropped precipitously in the last 5 to 7 years. And I had wondered, well, could the larvicide be affecting the larva of the monarch butterfly? Because the milkweed are seen along the ditch banks and so forth. But what I'm hearing, it sounds like it's not targeted. It's not broad spectrum like that.
I don't see how it could affect monarch butterflies at all.
Okay.
Or anything else as far as that goes.
What about the toxicity to humans?
Nothing.
Nothing at all?
Nothing.
Okay. So what about fogging? So when the fogging comes along, that's a little more broad spectrum.
It certainly is. We try to do that at night, so all we're getting are mosquitoes. We do it. We start about 8:30 dusk, and go to one. And they have to, when you're spraying adulticides, you have to be very, very careful with your wind to make sure that you're getting the biggest bang for your buck. And then a temperature, because at about 55 degrees, mosquitoes go to ground. They quit flying. And something else that we do with the city of Logan, I can't speak to anybody else.
Sure.
But we spray not on a regular basis. We spray as needed. Several reasons for that. Mostly, there's no sense in being out spraying adulticide when there's no the mosquito population's real low, and so we wait. We trap mosquitoes, and it doesn't reduce it, but we can get a good number count in an area, and we do it in 7 different locations within the city of Logan.
So tell me about the trapping process. Are you looking for a certain number? Do the mosquitoes get tested for West Nile? What are you looking for?
Yes, I get answered that fast. All the above. We numbers, and also what we do is we separate out. There's certain species that carry West Nile, some that don't. So we're looking for species. It's not a fun job. I've got a guy who does it with a smile on his face, and then we take them. They're dead, of course, and then we send them to the lab, and they compress it. And I don't know how they do it, but at any rate, they determine if there's any West Nile there.
Are you seeing that through your efforts that you're making progress with getting rid of mosquitoes? I mean, do you see the populations being reduced? Is there some way to measure what you're doing?
Not really. It's kind of it kind of depends on the temperatures and we had an early spring and then we had a late winter and all those things factor out. I think that we make things a lot better. All the mosquito districts make it things a lot better. Can you eradicate mosquitoes? No. There's several things out there that are promising genetically engineered mosquitoes, but that's out there a ways.
I guess it's a little bit like cloud seeding. You know, it gets done, and you know you get snow, but you don't know if it came from that or something else. So,
I think we do. I think all the districts do a great job at what they're attempting to do. They and most of us are really going for larva sighting because you can get so much more with you drop one briquette into a small pond and it kills all the larvae in there.
Is this something that you could use in a home pond?
Sure, yes.
So it wouldn't affect the fish, it wouldn't affect
nothing.
Any of the other insects that the fish might be feeding on or anything like that?
Correct.
Oh, that's good to know. I know there are products out there, like I'll use on my apple tree, the product called Spinosad, because I know it's specific to insects with chewing mouth parts, and it's a product from a bacteria like you were talking about. Mm-hmm. But I can eat the apples that same day because it doesn't hurt humans.
If you got fish in your pond, generally you don't have mosquitoes because
they're
busy eating them. No, that's almost the sign. If it's running water or if there's fish present, we still test, but we rarely have to put anything in.
So if you had all the money that you needed to, was there anything you would change in the program? I mean, would you, are you, you feeling like it's doing what it's set out to do?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't, you can always use a little more money, but I think we're hitting the target right now.
And for Logan, it's mostly, and it makes sense, you look at the valley topography, it's mostly on the west side of town.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I will spray a couple of times on the east side, but it's the west side that we work on the hardest.
Okay. Well, Joe, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Joe Archer is Logan City's forester, and we'll continue our conversation coming up in just a bit. But, Joe, again, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me today in the studio is Darren Cox. He's vice president for the American Honey Producers Association and also president of Cox Honey in Logan. And we're talking today about mosquito abatement districts and in particular how they might affect what you're doing with beekeeping. And you certainly have not only for a Utah perspective, but a national perspective being vice president with the Honey Producers Association. So I guess the first question is, tell me what you think about mosquito abatement districts.
You know, it is a public health concern. So the Center of Disease Control and other health agencies through the United States have came together and they want to try to control West Nile virus. When we look at trying to control something like mosquitoes, I don't think there's any way we're ever going to be able to get rid of all the mosquitoes. So they're trying to mitigate population controls through their efforts. It's my opinion that when we try to do these mitigation efforts, that there's a lot of best management practices that could be done to try to keep the populations down. And a chemical solution should be the very, very last solution that we use. There's many different natural ways of controlling mosquitoes, whether it's going to be building bird boxes that eat mosquitoes or having dragonfly nests or even using the late Dr. Ross Nilsson's work to where it was a form of decreased fitness. I can tell you that the cotton industry used that as one of their key products to get rid of the pink bollworm. And it was through irradiating that for 11 generations out that they would irradiate the males. And then when they mated with the general population, it would cause decreased fitness and it would wipe the species out.
Hmm. So as far as how most mosquito abatement districts are set up, mm-hmm. Are most of them spraying, is it a fogging, or are they doing more of a larvicide, just treating specific areas, or does it just change from one to the next?
I think they do the two-prong approach. I think they do the larvicide in your waters, and I also think that they do the fogging.
And from your perspective as a beekeeper, how does that affect what you do? Is there much in the way of residuals that affect the bees the next day?
The residuals is really, really unknown on many of these products because we have improper testing that was done by the EPA when these products came onto market. These products were only tested under a LD50 scale to where...
And what is an LD50 scale?
An LD50 scale represents the amount of lethality a product has within a 48-hour period. If it would kill at least, say, 50% of the test subjects.
Sounds quite high.
Yes. Now, Europe, I believe Europe is way ahead of us in this. They have came out with multi-tiered testing. They want to be able to test if it affects the reproductive part of the specimens or the memory loss or the lifespan or even if it makes them become lethargic. So they're really pulling a rake through it to try to understand chronic effects and unknown effects through their testings.
If the fogging is going on at night, we don't know how that affects bees the next day. I mean, I've heard that supposedly once it's on contact, there's not an issue. But what I'm hearing you say is we really don't know.
We really don't know as far as there's many different aspects you can look at it. You can look at it as we don't know what the full effect is going to be on the non-targets. We don't know what the full effects are going to be on honeybees as far as long-term chronic effects. If it could affect their memory, navigation, honey production, if it could affect their reproductive parts to where they become sterile. We really don't know that. When we're applying these products on at night, it's unknown. Also, if they're using a surfactant like diesel fuel to allow it to carry further from what they may have as an intended an intended target. We don't know if it gets out into people's yards and on their lawns for the stickers and adjuvants that go into these products, if it gets carried into people's homes on the carpet, or if windows are open, if it comes inside. Then what is the breakdown of these products inside of a dwelling versus outside of a dwelling on the grass? These are unknowns.
So why does it seem that Europe always seems to be one or two steps ahead of the U.S.?
I can't answer that question. I can tell you that the bee industry put together the Pelston Conference, and we pulled researchers in from around the world and put the best scientists together and was trying to figure out protocols for doing the testing, multi-tier testing. And we came together, and it kept getting filtered. And now that it's been completed, we still haven't got that put in place to where we were requiring multi-tier testing and life cycle testing on non-targets or targets.
Just again, from your perspective, do you see mosquito abatement spraying as being a positive or negative, or you're just not quite sure what side you come down on yet?
I think you have to have a balance in all things. There certainly is best management practices that could be implemented by the mosquito abatements. Understanding sensitive areas. There's understanding wind speeds when wind speeds are prohibitive. Understanding man hours, or are these individuals, is this their regular 40-hour week, or are we asking them to work overtime? Anytime you get into extra labor hours on individual, you just like Highway Safety Transportation Act, we start reducing the amount of hours that these truck drivers are able to drive, and you start reducing the amount of mistakes and accidents. There's been talk within the bee industry of trying to make all usage reporting mandatory. We believe that everybody has the right to know who sprays what, where, when, and why in our communities, so that we can be able to identify, is there a way that it is working, or is there a way that it's not working? Certainly when you get into doing fogging and products versus the larvicides, it's a whole different mechanism because it's a moving target instead of a singular target, to where there's a pond instead of a truck driving down a road. There's been talk of trying to come up with updated equipment that would have a barcode that would scan the product on and have GPS overlap mappings of the areas for sensitive and non-sensitive areas that would automatically alert the driver if the wind speed was too high, if they were too close to a sensitive target, or a target to where the citizens or landowners didn't want them to spray, or if they were too close to, say, a bird refuge or a school. And, another part of that is if they can spray at night and doing their fogging at night, you're going to have less people, out during their walks and around their communities and neighborhood. And the bees are done flying. So that's really, really the best time to apply it, if we're going to apply it.
However, my concern would be, I'm assuming you work with the abatement districts to make sure that you don't have hives in an area where they're going to be fogging. What about for the average homeowner? I mean, if I've got bees, a hive of bees in my backyard, I still don't want to have that chemical. I mean, I can smell it when it comes into the house, and we run around and try to close all the windows when we hear the truck going around. I don't want that going into the hive. How do you mitigate that?
I think the best way you can try to mitigate it's difficult when you have managed pollinators versus native pollinators. There's nobody from the native pollinators to say, you just wiped out my home and my nest. That's why my position is spraying should absolutely be an emergency, and it should be the last effort that is made.
So it shouldn't be done every single week just to be doing it?
It shouldn't be done in my opinion, it should not be done every single week. We should have thresholds developed to where we can understand our population dynamics, and when populations hit a certain point, whether it be West Nile infections or what they're trying to control, then we authorize spraying. Not just it's that time of the week and it's that time of the day. It doesn't matter if the wind's blowing or not. We certainly need to have our checks and balances.
I think sometimes I've heard the concern as well. The mosquito abatement district is set up. There's money there, so as long as there's money, we'll just do it.
Yeah, that's that's problematic. There's citizens out there that want it, and there's citizens out there that don't want it. And certainly by having a mapping and a timed route to where the landowners would be aware that, at 10:45 on this particular night, they know that the truck's going to come past. And if there is a computer built-in program into the trucks that automatically shut off by the property owner's request, that would take care of the problem.
Do you opt out of the spraying in the areas where your hives are?
No, where I run my locations, I've got locations throughout northern Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, California. I'm even into North Dakota.
So
now,
you're not so. Only having to worry about Cache Valley, you're having to worry about everywhere you've got your hives.
Right, and when you've got,
and the regulations are different from one to the next,
and they'll change from different states. When you've got over 100 locations like me, and trying to mitigate, you've got a bee yard with a 3-mile radius, and you've got wind speeds. That's why we have the label. The label dictates when it's safe to apply. If the wind's blowing, they're not supposed to apply it. Not just because it's that time of the night, it means that it's unsafe to use.
Do you think, for the most part, that they're being as strict as they should be about that?
I think they've gotten better. You know, back when West Nile first hit, we had a really major incident in the west side of Logan, to where there was an aerial spraying done. And it was done during daylight hours over the top of 2 stockyards, and over 1,000 hives of bees was severely damaged. I think they are becoming more and more aware that there is not just honeybees but managed pollinators in the area. But I think that we need to sit down at the drawing board and relook at things and figure out, okay, how can we do it better if we have to do it? And do we really, really have to do it?
Have you seen... do you think it contributes at all to the colony collapse?
I think
to the overall health of the bee industry.
The overall health of the bee industry, we're finding an average of almost 7 different insecticides in every pollen sample that was done at Penn State. Colony collapse disorder, for quite a period of time, we always viewed it as multifactorial. We had the importation of the Australian package bees that came in. We thought we were like mixing smallpox and Indians, smallpox and viruses like that, because Australian bees had viruses and that would never had before in our bees never seen that. So, but usually after you have a pandemic like that, within a 4-year time frame, it cycles out, and it has not cycled out. So now we're starting to take a harder look at some of these pesticide products that are out there that are systemic in nature.
So if it's in the pollen, does that mean that it's also in the honey?
Not necessarily. It depends on if it's a oil base or a product that can be transferred into the honey. I know a lot of your major honey packers all screen for pesticides in the honey.
And are you... So they're looking right now, like with the Penn State, can they track, well, okay, this chemical came in through mosquito abatement districts, for instance. Could they do it that way?
They may be able to do that way, but I have not heard of that kind of data. They're just talking about general pesticide findings that they found. And in fact, even in the umbilical cord between the mother and the child now, we're finding products that shouldn't be there.
Okay. Well, it sounds like there's a lot more work that needs to be done. Hopefully we'll proceed more cautiously in the future, because our food supply depends on it.
Well, our food supply depends on it. Our next generation would like to be able to have the same kind of environmental friendly ecosystem that we may have enjoyed as a child. But, you know, things are changing. It's a difficult position for the commercial beekeeper, because we basically live on the good graces of farmers in our community in order to have rental places to put our bees. And there's a very large polarized match going on right now. We've got the pesticide and chem industry and your ag community on one side. On the other side, we've got a lot of your environmental groups, and the bee industry is really stuck in the middle. And we're just trying to do the best thing we can to survive, but we certainly would like to see increased funding for our ARS research labs. We'd like to see more funding come from the President Obama's initiatives on our 2015 Farm Bill that just came through. But the pesticides that are here on the market, we'd like to see them start back screening and finding out what is the chronic effects of these products that may be having on our beehives.
Now, you have seen chemicals being taken off the market. I mean, diazinon used to be completely available, and it's gone. Do you see that continuing, where they're tightening up those regulations finally, so the products that are a little more pervasive and affect the environment more are being taken off?
As I see a lot of these products, some products can stay on the market for a longer period of time because they're not known to have serious health problems to humans, like your organophosphates. Your DDTs, when it was pulled off, we started seeing that residuals in our fats and in the mammals. The problem is a lot of these products are brought into the market under a Section 18, which is an emergency exemption. So all the testing hasn't been done.
So why is it an emergency?
It's always an emergency when you have crops that humans depend upon for food that are being destroyed by pests. And on the average, you know, I learned this on the PPDC, on average in the United States, we have two new pest species every week coming into the United States. So the farmers are really, really, really being challenged on how to protect their crops. And the beekeepers are being challenged by trying to keep their bees alive. And the chem companies, they want to be able to still be able to come out with effective controls in order to safeguard our food. And it takes a lot of extra money to do the kind of testing that Europe is requiring now. You know, there's a lot of talk in the news about the neonicotinoids and that they may be implicated in the bee health decline. I know Harvard just this week just released a study that kind of points to that direction. As I understand, it's well known that organochlorine pesticides have been banned as a group because of their inherent toxicity to many forms of life and their bioaccumulative properties. That's one thing we got to worry about is if they're going to bioaccumulate.
Kind of like what DDT.
Exactly like DDT, and they had that long persistence. That's why we can still find DDT today. The scary thing about that is, you know, the neonicotinoid, as I understand, is a new organochlorine pesticide that is from the same family of banned organochlorine, such as aldrin, dieldrin, and DDT. So just because you changed the patent doesn't mean you changed the effect.
And it sounds like, again, you're stuck right in the middle.
Beekeepers are stuck right in the middle. We're farmers. You know, we've got mites in our bees. We've got to be able to kill a bug on a bug. And we have to survive. At the end of the day, you know, on our PPDC work groups, we've got the bee industry is front, there, and center. We've got four different work groups that's heavily involved. We're traveling to the honey producers. We're sending people there half a dozen times a year trying to find out where can we find the balance. And a lot of it is improving management practices.
Well, Darren, we've run out of time. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate doing it. You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Darren Cox is vice president for the American Honey Producers Association and also president of Cox Honey in Logan. And stay tuned. Coming up next is a conversation with Ron Hellstern on the monarch butterfly. And in our gardening calendar, the USU Cache County Extension will host the Alternascapes Tour Saturday, June 7th from 11 to 4 p.m. The tour features unique gardens that capitalize on water-wise and Utah native plants for our arid mountain region. Tickets are available at the Cache County Extension office at 179 North Main or the Cache Valley Gardeners Market. And the Logan Iris Society has a couple of events coming up. Their annual flower show is next Friday and Saturday, May 30th and 31st. Friday from 1 to 7 p.m. and Saturday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church at 12 South 200 West in Logan. And you'll see a large selection of modern iris varieties. And for more information about how you can enter your own iris or just to come see the show, call 757-5102. They're also having an iris garden tour of three different homes, and they're all named irises. That's Saturday, June 7th from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. You begin at 171 West 300 North in Hyde Park, and then they'll give you a map at that location, and you can move on to the other two homes. Information about those items will be on the Utah Public Radio website at upr.org. Also coming up next month, the Tahnaquint Nature Center in St. George will feature a course on cactus and succulents. On June 14th, this is a Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m., learn plant selections and the general scope of cactus and succulent rearing. Admission is free. The Tahnaquint Nature Center is at 1851 South Dixie Drive. And then Moab is hosting their farmers market Thursdays from 5 to 8 p.m. at Suwannee City Park at 100 West and Park Drive. The market runs through October. Information is at moabfarmersmarket.com. Now, you just referring back to the mosquito abatement district conversation that we just had, if you want to opt out of having the abatement districts spraying around your home, you can do that, but you have to put in a request. For Logan City, the number is 716-9749, and the Cache County County Mosquito Abatement District has a form that you have to fill out. So just Google Cache County Mosquito Abatement District and then follow the directions for doing that. Right now in studio, we're going to have a conversation about monarch butterflies. And my guest is Ron Hellstern. He's chairman of the Cache Valley Wildlife Association. And Ron, I have to tell you, this kind of excites me because I've been putting caterpillars in my house since as long as I can remember. And I'm thankful to a first grade teacher who got this started with me. And so wherever I've seen milkweeds, I've always been on the lookout for monarch caterpillars to bring into the house and help them along their journey. So that's our conversation today. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Ron, thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here. Appreciate the offer.
So where did your interest come for monarch butterflies?
Same thing. I'm from Illinois originally, and I used to find a lot of interesting creatures in our acreage where we lived. Fireflies, lightning bugs, and I've only seen those once out here. But monarchs used to be all over the place. So when I came out here, I had that natural affinity for them. And I tried to pass it on to my students when I was teaching at South Cache. So the idea was to understand a little bit more about these amazing and beautiful insects and where they go in the winter for migration.
So what amazes you the most about the monarch butterfly?
I think the idea that, and I realize that there are some people out there that don't care too much whether butterflies are around or not, but I think the underestimation we have of pollinating insects and the importance they bring to us for our food crops and things is incredible. We need to have these creatures, birds that pollinate as well as butterflies and bees. But the interest came in trying to see if we could get them to understand a little bit more about how they their life cycle and how they migrate. And when we compare them to birds, because everybody's pretty familiar with how ducks and geese and swans and things migrate and robins and so forth, And the young birds are following their parents down to the southern migration overwintering sites. With monarchs, it's completely different, and it's amazing. It's not completely understood yet because the monarchs, the adult monarchs that we see up here live anywhere from 2 to maybe 6 weeks. But the migrating adults in late August, September that are heading back south, They don't mate, and they'll overwinter in sites on the eastern side of the Rockies down in Mexico and on the western states that go to Southern California. And they can live for 4, 5, 6 months until mating time comes. But the idea that's really unique about it is it's the fourth generation that actually migrates down there. And baby birds are following mom and dad south. But these monarchs are four generations away from the originals that started in Mexico or Southern California, and have since been replaced by parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents, but still return back to those overwintering sites. It's amazing.
Do we know how they know how to get back here?
Not completely. I think a lot of it has to do with chemoreceptors that they have, as well as the way they can determine polarized light and things like that. But I wouldn't be the first person to jump up and say, yeah, I know how they do that, because I'm not certain yet. And okay. I also don't know how do they get across the Great Basin Desert and things like that to get to California.
There must be some places that they go to in the middle of the desert in order to find the water and the energy to keep going that far.
Absolutely. They have to have the energy as well as water substances to keep them going. And that's one of the things I think we got involved with the Monarch program, which is in Southern California, to try and find out about the Intermountain Monarchs, Idaho, Utah, and so forth. Where do they go? What are the routes? And how can we protect or provide way stations for them to make sure they can make this journey? And we're seeing that the biggest problem has been habitat loss for them, because monarchs are extremely particular. They have one single host plant, and without that, the species will go extinct. And you and I were talking earlier about the article in the Audubon magazine where we know that at one point the most populated species on the planet was the passenger pigeon, perhaps billions, some people think, and they're all gone. And now we're down to the millions of monarchs, and they're depleting rapidly. And at least we got a pretty good idea why that's the case. Loss of milkweed, which is the sole plant that keeps them, keeps their the eggs and the larvae and so forth alive. They have to have that as a host plant. And then the overwintering forests in specific microclimates in Mexico and Southern California, as those are being logged sometimes illegally, that eliminates places for them to go.
I know. I've noticed in the last 10 years the population's just in my own backyard taking a nosedive. 2 years ago, I didn't see a one.
Yeah.
Last year, I saw one. So for me, I'm thinking, all right, so what I need to do is plant some milkweed. Now, the word weed might throw some people off. Is it? It's not on the noxious weed list, is it?
Okay. It is not. It's not treated by the state
or
the
county.
Let's
call it a milk plant.
I like milk plant or butterfly plant.
There we go.
Call it that.
Better.
So the idea that it is the single host plant. Monarchs have not been seen. There was a rumor one time they went on dog BAME. That's never been verified. So it's milkweed or nothing, and they'll go extinct. And like you say, most people look at it, it's a weed. It's not a noxious weed. We just need to take a look. As acreage disappears, when I started this project back in 1998 at South Cache, and our students would go, we'd get 125 and so forth and tag and release them and let them go. And this last year, we had three that were called into me that we would mark. And I'd ask schools, too, if they have any, and the larva pupates and comes out of the chrysalis as a butterfly, wait 3 days, call me, we'll come mark it, and then the schools can have it and let it go at their own leisure. But the numbers have just been dropping precipitously.
To me, there's just nothing more spectacular than to be able to watch this life cycle in a jar in your own home. And then I guess that's why I started it when I was 5 and 6 years old, because you get to see them grow from these tiny little caterpillars to, within a matter of days, they're humongously bigger, and then to go through the whole pupation process. And once in all of my years, I was able to catch a chrysalis popping open with that butterfly. Hmm. You know, I just was just waiting and waiting and waiting, and every time I went past the table, I'd watch and watch. And I just happened to see that little slit open up, and it's like, oh, cool.
Here we go.
It is just the most amazing thing to watch. Yeah. So you were saying before the program, if a human baby were to eat as much as a caterpillar, how large would it get?
If you take a 6-pound human baby, and if it ate at the same rate that a monarch larva does, then within 2 weeks it would weigh 16,000 pounds. They'll put on 2,700 times their own weight from the time they get started. So it's a very small larva that comes out of that egg. It eats the eggshell first, and it starts eating the little hairs on the bottom of the milkweed leaf, and then eats and eats and eats 24 hours a day so it can put on the fat and grow into the stages it needs to get up into the chrysalis and eventually become a metamorphosized into the adult.
So to help with this project, if you're looking for a milkweed, where would you find milkweed?
And there may be a question, too, of what species. And just the common milkweed, if you're worried about, when you look at milkweed garden supplies and things like that, look at the stuff that's just growing around the area here in Cache Valley. You usually find it on roadsides and ditch banks are the easiest place to locate those. I know that I can't imagine that farmers and agriculture industries are going to want to have milkweed all over their fields. That's not a cash crop for them, so that's understood. But that's why we need to take a look at supplanting those in our own gardens and yard areas and so forth, because they won't take over a yard. You can pretty much control them. But yeah,
they're okay to have in the ditch bank. There's no reason to get rid of them. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, they're not doing any harm there, and they do produce. They're a prolific seed producer. There's no question. They've got the little silky parachute things that'll help them get off and get going. But and blow around the area. But again, if they land in places that's not conducive to have that seed germinate, then it's not going to take over a place either.
And milkweeds are not invasive. If you plant them in your own home, you're not going to find them like quack grass or something getting into the neighbor's yards or
the
into your flower bed.
Soil's got to be ready and bare in some areas where it's got to be taken over. But again, I can think of when we were in South Cache, we'd take the classes out and hike down towards the Hiram Reservoir and pass open fields that were loaded with milkweed. all that's gone now because it's been replaced by housing. I've got nothing against development. I'm just saying that that's one of those things you've got to take a look at, that it's a fact.
So are you looking for the caterpillars on the undersides of the leaves?
Exactly. You find a milkweed patch, and usually they're in some of the uppermost leaves, but they're always on the underside. The females know enough to give that chrysalis little protection. And they're not cocoons. They're not spinning. It's a chrysalis that's formed from the outer layers of the larva's skin. And so you can tell when they're getting ready to do that. They'll climb up to the top of this leaf itself of the plant. They'll stay on the underside of it and have a little organ by its mouth called a spinneret, and they spill kind of like a silky substance, and then turn around and their backside, they've got a little hook called a cremaster, and they hook onto that, and then they get into kind of a little J shape. When you see that letter J, then they're ready to start forming into the chrysalis shape. And then within about 2 weeks, 1 to 2 weeks in that time period, it'll metamorphosize into the adult butterfly.
Are there that many predators with monarch butterflies?
The biggest thing to do, I think, is if you're interested in helping this out, this project, so we can tag these butterflies, is to catch the caterpillars when they're quite small. Once they get to full size, about 2 inches, there's a fly called the tachinid fly. The females will come around and with an ovipositor stick in the back of that caterpillar and inject an egg. That egg will then eat the caterpillar inside out and kill it, but you get a fly, and the fly looks just like a regular house fly. So there's the predators on caterpillars, normally not, because the milkweed plant itself has got a toxin in it, and so most vertebrates don't mess around with the caterpillars at all. There are a couple of bird species, black-backed orioles and grosbeaks, that will eat adults, but most of the times birds, jays and things, when they eat that, they actually vomit and get quite sick, and they've learned, I'm not eating that again, and they pass that information on to their offspring. And so most of the time those bright colors in nature indicate you probably don't want to mess with me. I'm not going to taste good.
Okay. And if people want to contact you and let you know that they've got some caterpillars and want to have them tagged.
I always write a letter to the editor in the Herald Journal late August into September, asking for schools. Once you get back in, go ahead and have them in your classrooms, but give me a call. My phone number is 435-512-6938. You can also look, we're just developing this brand new, it's the only affiliate with the National Wildlife Federation in the state of Utah through the Cache Valley Wildlife Association. We're getting asked to have booths set up all over the place now, so we'll be at the Gardener's Market and the Bear River Celebration and Nibley Heritage Days and the Mountain Music Festival in Mendon and so forth. But if nothing else, Google us at Cache Valley Wildlife Association, and it'll pull up. Our website should be going within a day or two. We're just putting it together right now.
We've got about 9 more minutes if you'd like to join our conversation. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or you can go online to upr.org and send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So with the monarch butterfly, you see all different sizes. Are the females typically smaller in size or larger? Are they? I sometimes see a little bit difference in the patterns. What are the differences?
Females can be a little bit larger, but it's pretty tough to tell from a distance. From 6 feet or so, it's rough. But if you get up close, they've got multifaceted eyes, and so you've got to be careful as you approach. But it's difficult to tell unless you have a chance to get a male and a female together. But I've got a sample here. The male on the bottom hind wings has got a little black dot on the bottom wing, and where the veins are a little bit thicker. Again, probably chemoreceptors there. But otherwise, they look almost identical.
Yeah, I can't really see much difference between the two at all.
Yeah, let me see here. See the male, the black dot right here, a little bit lower on the wing. That's it. So again, and the interesting thing, I guess, between butterflies and moths is that butterflies will open and close wings and moths won't. So if you can get up close enough, catching an adult butterfly is going to be a little bit tricky, and you might damage it anyway. So the best thing is to get the larva. And then I guess we should talk a little bit about how we were trying to track these things.
Yeah, one of the concerns is having the types of plants that will attract all different kinds of pollinators, not just butterflies, but birds and bees as well. And I've seen a trend in some of the sunflower seed varieties that you can get that are pollenless. and like, okay, well, that's not going to do a whole lot of good. So what do you suggest?
Yeah, native plant species obviously are the way to go because any of the pollinators and local birds and things, that's what they're looking for. They're used to it, and they're used to the climate and so forth. I'm always a little bit depressed when I go into some of the bigger box stores and they're selling anything that says grows best, you know, in zone 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
They will not survive here. Save your money, folks. Look for the things that are at the 3, 4, 5 zone range, and those will grow and prosper here. But from the studies that I've seen, the number one plant that butterflies really like to have is Mexican sunflower called Tithonia, but also a butterfly weed, Buddleia, which is butterfly bush, but any of the great nectar producers and pollen producers, purple coneflower, penstemons and things like that that would normally grow here anyway, daisies and things that would be here, that's what they're looking for, and they'll use it. But if you're trying to attract them to your yard, they'll come through and they'll eat. It's kind of like a fast food restaurant. They'll come by and eat something. But if you want them to linger and to do an overproduction or a reproduction in that series, then they have to have milkweed too. So a great backyard garden would have water and nectar sources and the host plant milkweed and some shelter too.
So how easily can you grow a milkweed from seed?
They're not difficult as far as it goes, but again, germination rates are never 100% on any particular plant. So when you look for the milkweeds, my students used to say that the seed pods kind of look like dill pickles to them. And when those things start to open up, you'll see, you know, hundreds of seeds in each one of those, and they have to be massively produced because they don't all germinate. So, but they can be grown in pots or in garden spots too.
And if you see the seed pods, what's the best way to do? Just take a handful of them and gently cover them a little bit with the seed. As we've learned from Dan Drost, extension vegetable specialist, he said you never plant a seed more than 3 times the depth of its thickness. So with these seeds, they're not that thick. So you don't put very much soil on the top.
Exactly. I think just get it in and barely cover it. Remember that they're going to be airborne because you've got these little silken parachute things and taken around. So probably not trodden into the soil very deep. So when we're going to plant them, I can just barely cover them with soil, make sure that they're going to be good and moist, and sit back, cross your fingers, wait for the weather and nature to do the rest.
And the winter just takes care of it?
Yep.
And I imagine they probably have to have some cold hours to them, which is why you don't plant them in the spring.
Right. So they have to be scarified, and there's two ways you can do that. One is to take the seeds out and put them in a jar. You can put sand in there or something like that and shake the jar around and scratch the surface to get them going, or a winter substance, so they get in freezing, keep them in your refrigerator, things like that, so they've got that cold temperature to get them ready to go in the spring.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. We have just a couple minutes left with Ron Hellstern. He is the chairman of the Cache Valley Wildlife Association, and we're talking about monarch butterflies. And if you'd like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495, or you can go online and send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So for this summer, are there any ideas how the populations are going to be? What did the California overwintering areas look like?
Yeah, the populations are down considerably, and there's a couple reasons for that. I know that you see pictures in magazines once in a while. There are millions or certainly hundreds of thousands of butterflies covering trees. In Mexico right now, the Oyamel trees, they need a specific microclimate. So when they leave the U.S. and they're heading down to Mexico, they're up in these forests where the temperature is cool enough so their metabolism slows down so they don't use up all their food deposits and they don't have to worry about feeding during that time. The illegal logging going down there has been incredible, and I think right now, last I've heard, that they've got about 2% of the original forest that they used to have these butterflies come in. Only 2% remains. And you know what California's like if you've been there recently, the coastal forests, just because of housing. And I'm not saying that butterflies populations are more important than human development and human housing. I'm not saying that at all. But if one thing happens, then the result happens too. You pick up one end of the stick, the other end of the stick comes up with it. So I would just hate to see this, where the only place that our grandkids are going to be able to see monarchs may be in a museum or something like the passenger pigeon. So again, trying to track these things, where we mark them, we used to put small tags in the butterfly wings, and found out that when they would roost by the thousands in these trees, the people in the overwintering sites couldn't tell where the tags were from. And so they've now come up with 15 different marking patterns with a felt tip pen and 4 different colors. So there's 60 different color patterns. So now with a pair of binoculars, these scientists can take a look up in these trees and see what the color and the marking is. And they know exactly what region those butterflies came from. And then we know a little bit about retracing the route. And can we have way stations with, again, milkweed and nectar plants along the way to maintain this population?
Is there anything to indicate that our butterflies head further south and then cut across, or do they go directly straight from, at least here in Cache Valley, across the mountain?
Of the hundreds we've tagged since 1998, we've had a report of one being seen in Southern California. How it got there is still a mystery. So that's why we're trying to get more and more people to get involved with this.
Especially because we have fewer and fewer monarchs.
Exactly. So I think I've talked with folks in the Audubon Society. I'm a member of their board of trustees, too. I think we're going to try to marshal the forces and really go out and try and get as many larvae as we can in August, September, raise them as adults, mark them, and get them out of here as soon as possible. When the temperature hits 40 degrees, the butterflies are doomed. They don't even fly after it hits 55, so we need to get them out of here as soon as possible.
Okay, and to contact you, your phone number is 435-512-6938.
Correct.
And it's Ron Hellstern. He's chairman of the Cache Valley Wildlife Association. So be on the lookout for those orange, beautiful monarch butterflies this August and September.
They can also email me if they want. Okay. I love Southern Utah, Zion National Park. If you just think of redrockron, R-O-N, @gmail.com, I'd be glad to visit with you on email.
Okay, great. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Thank you for joining us on today's program. We'll have Petals and Pros back next week.